Last week in the sermon, I talked about how the Lord delays his coming. People are saying in their heart, in other words, they exhibit in the actions and the things they do and the things they say, that our Lord delays his coming. And although they may not actually say those words outright, it was a case of it's reflected in what they do say, it's reflected in what they do do. And as my wont, I ran out of time. I was talking about the First and Second Syrian League that actually took place when Israel was... Because let's face it, when people are saying the Lord delays his coming, do not see the imminency of what is actually about to happen to Israel. And if we go back to ancient Israel, neither did they. Even though Amos got up there and 50, 60 years before, gave them the prophecies and told them, in fact, what was coming, the fact that they would be taken away captive unless they repented. They said this punishment that the Eternal is bringing on us is delayed. It's been going on for years and years, and it didn't actually occur. And besides, we have the Syrian League that will counter what was coming from Assyria. It was interesting, I was talking to Mr. Henderson about what he was about to speak on, and he was talking about speaking on Psalm 15 and the parallels between Psalm 15 and the Matthew 5, 6 and 7. And I thought, well, why don't I actually do something a little bit different in that sense, and that is carry on from where I left off last time regarding the Syrian League. But I'll do so by examining another psalm, because there is another psalm that we can actually look at. And it's a psalm very much to do with confederacy, and it's very much to do with an end time focus. And I suggest you put your marker in there in Psalm 83. Psalm 83. Because here in Psalm 83, you read various commentaries as to what it's talking about and who's being referred to. And certainly Adam Clark's commentary, which I have, I don't know whether I got it in full, but I bought it in the second-hand bookshop and checked in Adam Clark's commentary. And he's pretty adamant that it's to do with Jehoshaphat and what actually took place at that time. But let's just read through the psalm initially, and then we'll have a look at certain aspects of it. It says, "Keep not you silent, O God. Hold not your peace. Be not still, O God. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. They've taken crafty counsel against your people, and they've consulted against your hidden ones. They've said, Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they've consulted together with one consent, they're all confederate against you." So they're pointing out that they're confederate against God. It's not against Israel, it's against God that they're actually being confederate against. And here's the list. The tabernacles of Edom, the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebel and Ammon, Amalek, and the Philistines were the inhabitants of Tyre. Asser is also joined with them, and they've helped the children of Lot, Selah. And as far as we understand, Selah means think about this. Just stop. Let's have a pause in the music so you can actually think about what has just been sung. Because remember, the Psalms are songs. And they're prophetic songs as well, incidentally. "Do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin, at the brook of Kishon, which perished at Endor, they became as dung of the earth. Make the nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yes, all their princes as Zeba or Zalmunna, who said, Let us take ourselves the house of God as a possession. O my God, make them like a wheel, as a stubble before the wind. As a fire burns a wood, and as the flame sets the mountains on fire, so persecute them with your tempest, and make them afraid with your storm. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O Eternal. Let them be confounded and troubled forever, yes, let them be put to shame and perish, that men may know that you, whose name alone is," it says Jehovah here, is Yahweh, or Yahweh, YHWH, "are the Most High God, or Most High over all the earth." I thought it was worthwhile reading right through to remind us about, you've probably read the psalm, I would say, many times probably before, but it's worth reading it right through just to remind us what it actually says from start to finish. And as I said, if you go to Adam Clarke's commentary, in fact, I won't go into it. Basically, what he refers you back to, let's just turn back to 2 Chronicles 20. Because certainly, looking at 2 Chronicles 20, although you've got to bend things a great deal to get it to fit this particular passage of Scripture, it is a valid passage of Scripture. It's a valid incident where God intervenes in Israel, well, in Judah's life as it is, and causes them to, he actually fights the battle for them. And it came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them others beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. And there came some and told Jehoshaphat, saying, "There comes a great multitude against you from beyond the sea on this side of Syria. And behold, they be in Hazon Tamar, which is in Engedi." Engedi, it seems strange, you know, Syria is up in the north, but Moab and Ammon was down where Jordan is today. But Engedi is on the side of the western side of the Dead Sea. So they gathered in Engedi. Engedi, I remember having actually been there. It's a beautiful place. It's you go through bamboo forests. It's about 1,000 feet below sea level, and there's bamboo and bananas growing down there at this time now. But it's a beautiful place with waterfalls and so on. So, behold, they're in Hazon Tamar, which is Engedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Eternal and proclaimed a fast throughout all of Judah. And Judah gathered themselves together to ask help of the Eternal. Even unto all the cities of Judah they came to seek the Eternal. And Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Eternal before the new court, and said, "O Eternal God of our fathers, are you not God in heaven, and do you not rule over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in your hand is there not power and might, that none is able to withstand you? And are you not our God, who did drive out the inhabitants of the land before your people Israel, and gave it to the seed of Abraham, your friend, forever? And they dwelt therein, and they have built their sanctuary therein for your name, saying, If when evil comes upon us, and the sword, judgment, or pestilence, or famine, we stand before this house, and in your presence, for your name is in this house, and cry unto you in our affliction, then you will hear and help." So he was doing this in front of the temple. And the temple area built by Solomon, is what would be great-great-grandfather? Several great-grandfathers, anyway, going back a while. "And now, behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not." So there's only three nations there, notice, basically. "Behold, I say how they reward us to come to cast out us out of our possession which you have given us to inherit. O our God, will you not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that comes against us, neither do we know what to do, but our eyes are upon you." So even if this is not, Psalm 83 has nothing to do with this incident, this incident certainly is reflecting the same kind of incident that Psalm 83 is about. The fact that they're under dire circumstances, and the only one to actually give relief is God himself. There is no solution. And in Israel's case, Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh and the rest of Israel at the end time, they will become slaves in other nations' lands and be transported into other nations' lands. And they will have no strength. And the only one that will save them is going to be Jesus Christ and his return. So, although it may not be, it can be shown that there's some severe problems with this being the incident, it was written about something. And whenever it was written, this certainly reflects an incident. Notice in verse 20 it says, "And they rose early in the morning, and they went forth in the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, Hear me, O Judah, and you inhabitants of Jerusalem, believe in the Eternal your God, and so shall you be established. Believe his prophets, and so shall you prosper. And when he consulted with the people, he appointed singers to the Eternal, that they should praise the beauty of holiness. And they went out before the army, and to say, Praise the Eternal, for his mercy endures forever. And when they began to sing and to praise, the Eternal set ambushments against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, which were come against Judah." So there are only three nations Now that in Psalm 83 there are far more than that. There are 10 nations mentioned. So this is why I say there are things that point in a different direction. For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, utterly to slay and destroy them. And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, everyone helped to destroy another. They all killed each other. And when Judah came down with Jehoshaphat, they found everything. And behold, they're all dead men, I think it was, wasn't it? In one passage. But you know, although Adam Clarke's is quite adamant about... it is, isn't it? Adam Clarke is quite adamant about the fact that this is Jehoshaphat being mentioned. What you need to understand is who were the people here who was being threatened? Was it Israel? Well, no, it wasn't Israel at all. It was Judah. It was Judah. And Judah and Israel are two separate nations, and very clear these separate nations at this time. Ahab was on the throne in Israel, and Jehoshaphat was on the throne in Judah. And it was Judah that was under threat, and Judah was the one that was being threatened. And in addition to that, when you look at, if we go and turn back to Psalm 83, notice in verse 4, just to stay on this point for a little while, it says, "They come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance." So it is specifically about Israel here in Psalm 83. Jehoshaphat was about Judah. In addition to that, notice in verse 8, Asser is the father of Assyria. Asser also is joined with them. They've helped the children of Lot, Salah. So the final capstone was that Assyria was going to go ahead and be part of this confederation that is against Israel. And therefore, again, Assyria certainly was not in this particular league that you're looking at occurring at the time of Jehoshaphat. Now, if I can give you again a little bit more about the things I was talking about in the previous sermon, this Battle of Quagar, which was the reason why it's important, or the reason why it's something that people on the outside accept as happening, is they've got evidence of the battle taking place and of Ahab being there at the battle as part of the Confederacy. And this, again, was around the same time as Jehoshaphat, or it's just slightly before, probably, Jehoshaphat. And it says, this is under in Wikipedia, I think it is. No, it's not. It's another section on the Battle of Quagar. It says, "The Assyrian king Salmaneser III was a remarkable warrior who often fought against the city-states in the west. In 857, he reached the Amanus Mountains and the Mediterranean shores." Now remember, he's coming from Assyria. He's coming from Nineveh. So he came across from the area of Mosul, which is on the Tigris. And in 857, he reached the Mediterranean shores. And in the next year, he settled the Assyrians in this land. Far from stabilizing the region, it led to an escalation. So he went in there to try and settle things down a bit as the dominant power in the area, as dominant power coming from Assyria. And to settle them down, he put people in the land to oversee governmental functions. And that really put the cat among the pigeons. The remaining city-states and kingdoms in the west united in a defensive alliance and seemed to have tried to create dissension within Assyrian realms. So they actually went in the opposite direction for him. So this was Salmaneser III that actually this happened. And what then took place is that there was a Kirk Stella, which is in the British Museum in London, and this particular stela, this particular obelisk, contains the information of his campaign and this battle. And it says, in that Kirk stela, he lists 12 nations that were actually arrayed against him, 12 kings arrayed against him. And one of the lines said what was arrayed against him was 2,000 chariots and 10,000 troops of Ahab, the Israelite. So there was actually a Syria, and this was Syria, was, so it says 1,200 chariots and 1,200 cavalry, 20,000 troops of Adahazer of Damascus. That's was Syria. So this was the aspect. Now, when you're looking at Psalm 83, you find that Assyria was joined with them. In the case of the Syrian League that was taking place at this time, that could not be, and in no way could it be, because Assyria was the one that actually caused the Syrian League to take place, the League of Nations, if you like, in that area. So Salmaneser 3 and his monolith, if you like, knock that on the head. Another thing to notice here in Psalm 83, in verse 16, fill their faces with shame. Why? That they may seek your name, O Eternal. That has a millennial ring about it. There's very much a millennial ring about it. And verse 18, that men may know that you, whose name alone is the Eternal One, the I Am, I Was, I Am, I Will Be, the Yahweh, are the Most High over all the earth. So again, it has a millennial ring about it. And when we read this, you can't help but just think, well, this isn't talking about what took place years and years and years ago. It's talking about something that is yet to take place. It's talking about something that we will witness, undoubtedly. And it's worthwhile keeping this psalm in mind and keeping this psalm prominent in our mind as we watch the news and we see the alliances that are being made in the Middle East. And certainly as we go down and go through the psalm in a little bit more detail, we'll see that being the case. So the psalm starts off, it says, keep not your silence, O God. Hold not your peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. Now, if you keep a marker in there, and you go back to Psalm 2, this certainly is going to be the case at the end time, because here in Psalm 2 it says, why do the nations rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Eternal and against his anointed, his Messiah, saying. So again, this is an end time psalm. This is one of the psalms Mr. McNair would have brought out, undoubtedly. In fact, probably the first psalm he brought out when he was talking about this. Let us break their bands asunder, let us cast away their cords from us. He that sits in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. You see, this again could be talking about the same thing. The almighty dollar and the servitude to the dollar may be what is in fact being talked about here. But you see, what he does go on and describe, it says, then shall he speak to them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Zion being the church, Zion being the location, the height of Zion being the height of in Jerusalem, the center of the church. I'll declare the decree, said the Eternal has said to me, you are my son, this day have I begotten you. Ask of me and I shall give you the heathen as your inheritance and the uttermost part of the earth for your possession. This is a millennial psalm. It is the millennial psalm right at the very beginning of the millennium and just leading up to the beginning of the millennium. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Quoted in Revelation, specifically. Be wise now, therefore, you kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Perhaps talking to us as judges, as future kings. Serve the Eternal with fear, rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and perish from the way. Mr. Henderson brought out regarding, well, Matthew 7, isn't it? What does it actually say there? Not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and in name cast out demons? They say, I profess to you them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. So it's a case of knowing God. It says, kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish from the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little, Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. So again, this is an end time psalm, it's an end time prophecy. And when you're looking here in Psalm 83, it talks about, below your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted against your hidden ones. I'll turn over to Isaiah 16. Isaiah 16. Now, there are going to be some hidden ones in the future. There are going to be some individuals that need to be hidden by two of the co-conspirators that are there and are being helped by Assyria specifically. Here in Isaiah 16, it says, verse 1, it says, "Send you the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah," which is Petra. Selah is the Hebrew, meaning a rock. Petra is the Greek, meaning a rock. And it's known as Petra today because the Hellenic culture that went through during the time of Christ at that time, and that name stuck rather than being Selah. But it's exactly the same place, it's exactly the same word being used. "So the ruler of the land from Petra to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be as a wandering bird cast out of the net, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast, betray not him that wanders." So when the church flees, it's got to be hidden somewhere. This is, again, another indication that that place will be Petra. Not saying categorically, but it is one more nail in the coffin for any other idea. "Let my outcasts dwell with you, Moab. Or rather, as for Moab, be you a covert to them, for the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, and the spoiler seats, and the oppressors are consumed of the land. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging, and she is seeking judgment and hastening righteousness." So in other words, if Moab and Ammon do this, and they hide the outcast and they look after the people within the place of safety, they will then be blessed when Christ takes up the job that he will have at that particular time. And going back now to Psalm 83, here are this group of individuals that have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted against your hidden ones. So it's not just against the people of Ephraim and Manasseh, Britain and America, Canada, Australia and so on, and the rest of Israel. That's not just what he's talking about. He's talking about the church as well. Every indication is that he's talking about the church as well. He says, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel shall be no more in remembrance." It's interesting when you think about the outrage against Israel. Posted on our news was an article from the Telegraph, literally on the 9th. What date is it? 12th today, so 3 days ago. It says, "In the last 24 hours alone, over 120 rockets have been fired on southern Israel. That's approximately 5 rockets per hour." I mean, you imagine living in an area where 5 rockets per hour, how can you work? Okay, you live your life in a shelter. Live life underground. "Where's the outrage from the United Nations, which doesn't hesitate for a moment to call a special emergency session on the question of Palestine, or pass the umpteenth resolution blindly condemning Israel? But 24 hours after the rocket attacks on Israel started, I'm still waiting for even one syllable of condemnation from the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, or the Human Rights Council." You think, why is that? What is it? Why are they confederate against Israel? Why are they confederate against your hidden ones? What's the problem? "Where is the EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, who repeatedly slams Israel over settlement building, but is yet to say a word about the Palestinians firing over 120 rockets on the Israeli civilians in one day? Even 10 Downing Street and the Foreign Office have yet to comment. Where are all those so-called enlightened liberals who continue to call for boycott, divestment and sanctions against the Jewish state, but are silent in the face of Palestinian terror against the Jews?" You've just got to watch the news to see the bias. But why? What's the purpose? Why is that the case? Where's the outrage from the mainstream media? Instead, news organisations like the BBC lead their stories about the rocket attacks headlines like with headlines like Israel launches new airstrikes on Gaza Strip, and not Palestinian terrorists on Gaza raid down over 120 rockets against 1 million Israelis in 24 hours. It just doesn't happen that way. And the answer, I personally feel, is if you turn over to Romans chapter 8. Turn over to Romans chapter 8. Because there is a God of this world, and that God hates something, vehemently hates something. And what he vehemently hates is given here in Romans chapter 8. In verse 5. For they that are after the flesh set their mind on the things of the flesh. But they that are after the Spirit set their mind on, with ellipses, the things of the Spirit. What are the things of the Spirit? Well, the things of the Spirit are the laws of God. Because that expresses the things of the Spirit. It codifies the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace. And because the carnal mind is enmity. It hates. It is our opposition. It is utter detestable. Counts as utterly detestable. Against God. For it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So then they that are in the flesh cannot please God. And the reason why you see what you see within the Middle East is that, the Quran, they put up with the Quran. But with the people that give us the book, and the ones that give us the basis, the foundation for the book, the Hebrew scriptures, they hate it. I hate it. And although it's, people try and label it anti-Semitism. It's not anti-Semitism, it's anti-God. That's what it is. It's anti-God. And that's what, in fact, is happening. They've said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel will be no more in remembrance, going back to Psalm 83 now. For they've consulted together with one consent. They're confederate against you. And the tabernacle, and if we just go through and actually look at some of these names and just ask ourselves, well, where are these people that are confederate against them? Because before we go into the actual names themselves, let's just turn back to 2 Kings 16, and just again remind ourselves. Why it wasn't the case of Jehoshaphat, it wasn't the Second Syrian League which took place. It's going to be different from the Second Syrian League. Because 2 Kings 16, verse 5, it says, then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war, and they besieged Ahaz, but they couldn't overcome him. Now this is the Second Syrian League. The Syria was an association with several other nations, the other nations in that particular area. And at the time, Rezin, king of Syria, and it's interesting, when you're looking at Psalm 83, there is no Syria mentioned. Syria is not mentioned there at all. But Assyria is. And yet Assyria was the actual antithesis of the Second Syrian League, as it was of the First Syrian League. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elath to Syria and drove the Jews from Elath, and the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there to this day. Now, Elath is right down the very southern part of Israel. It's a beautiful area for scuba diving. In fact, it's on the Red Sea. It's one of the world-renowned places. It's almost equal to the Great Barrier Reef in this scuba diving. So Ahaz sent messages to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son, come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Assyria. The king of Syria. Again, get the two correct. Syria was part of the confederacy here. Assyria was the one that they were confederate against here. And out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And Israel was part of that confederacy. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Eternal and the treasures of the king's house, and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria to pay his army, in other words. And the king of Assyria listened to him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, which is Syria, and took it and carried the people off captive to Kir, and they slew Rezin. And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser and Saul. So, when we're looking at the, if you go back to Psalm 83 again, we can actually see that they, for they have consulted together with one consent, they're confederate against you, and they're against you being God, and against you being God with his law, and also the hidden ones as well. The indication is that this is not talking about something that took place years and years ago. It's talking about something that is yet to happen, something that we will probably witness to some degree. In fact, we might feel that the pointed end of this to some degree. Because if you're going, if Petra is the place, if it is the place, and you're going into this area, and they're all confederate against you, and Assyria's in amongst them as well, what kind of reception are you going to get? Again, this might be very pertinent indeed to us. But they have consulted together with one consent. They're confederate against you. The tabernacles of Edom and East. So who are the tabernacles of Edom? Teman. Teman was one of the major cities of Edom. You'll find it in scripture. And it also is the root behind the word Ottoman, Ottoman Turks. So you tie the two together, and you see today Turkey, which is Esau or Edom today. So the tabernacles of Edom, which is Turkey, and the Ishmaelites, the people that descended from Ishmael, which are the Arabs that we have today. And so we've got Turkey and the Arabs in there. We're looking at it in a modern context. And of Moab, that is an area covered by Jordan today, as far as we understand. So we're looking at Jordan. And the Hagarenes. Now, who are the Hagarenes? Well, basically they're the Eens of Hagar. the bairns of Hagar. The mother of Ishmael. Again, the Arabs. But there's a little bit more to it than that. If we turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 5. 1 Chronicles chapter 5. You find that it was actually a tribe, and so presumably in amongst the Arabs somewhere there is a tribe who are the Hagarenes or Hagarines or Hagarites, as it mentions here in First Chronicles 5, verse 10. It says, in the days of Saul they made war with the Hagarites, who fell by the hand, and they dwelt in the tents throughout all the east land of Gilead. So here are the Hagarites being mentioned as a separate nation. And you find them also in verse 19. It says, they made war with the Hagarites, with Jetur and Nephish and Nodab. And they were helped against them. And the Hagarites were delivered into their hand, and all were with them. And they cried to God in the battle, and he was entreated of them because they put their trust in him. So it's talking about the Manassites actually having a war against this particular tribe, which were specifically called the Hagarites or Hagarenes. Now, so within the Arab world, there is a tribe. Where exactly it is today, we don't know. We don't know where it is. But there's a tribe of Arabs who obviously are all part of Ishmael and all came from Abraham and Hagar. So, and Gebel, in verse 7 now of Psalm 83, Gebel, if you turn over to Joshua chapter 13. Joshua was about to die, he says in verse 1, it says he was old and well stricken in years, and the Eternal said to him, you are old and stricken in years, and remains yet much land to be possessed. And this was one of the areas that was yet to be possessed in verse 5. And the land of the Gibeonites, and all of Lebanon, towards the sun rising from Baal Gad unto the Mount Hermon and to the entering of Hamath. And basically, when you're looking at Gebel, it was in the area of Lebanon. And they didn't get rid of them. they stayed in that area. It was really part of the Canaanite tribes, but when I say Canaanite tribes, they may not have been black, but they would have been part of the same kind of groupings under the Canaanite leadership. Today, if you go just north of Beirut, there's an area there called Jabail, J-B-A-I-L, which comes from Gebel. It's the same area. It's between Beirut and Tripoli, which is further north again. So that area seems to be an indigenous group of people. Who is this, the Gebel, that is mentioned over here in Psalm 83? There's no reason to suppose that, and you think about what happened to Lebanon, and the chaos is going on in Lebanon right now. Two of these groupings here are to do with Lebanon. I always think, whenever the subject of Lebanon comes up, I always think of Salam Madani. And, back in the, was it 70s, wasn't it? I think it was 70s. But he and his wife Judy flew back into Lebanon. He was Lebanese. And he flew back into Lebanon after the feast with their two children. Yeah. And that was the first bombing of the Lebanese. It was on their plane, and they all died as it actually came into land. And from that time, Lebanon has been absolute chaos. They were taken away out of the trouble to come. But it was in, that was in the 70s, in the early 70s, or in the middle of the 70s. 74, was it? Something like that, yeah. So something along that time. But they all lost their life. And one of the areas, just north of Beirut, which is the center of all this chaos, it was a paradise on the Mediterranean. It was renowned for its holiday destination. You try going to Lebanon today, I doubt if you get a flight in there, quite frankly, today. And that has been the case right the way from that time in the 70s when Salam Madani and his family were killed, lost their life in that bombing. But Gebel, or Jabail, is north of Beirut, south of Tripoli, in Lebanon today. Ammon is part, with Moab, is part of Jordan. The Jordanians represent that area. Amalek. If you turn over to Genesis chapter 36, let's just remind ourselves a little bit about who Amalek is. Again, you can find these people. Genesis 36, verse 8, it says, "Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir." Esau is Edom. And these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. And these are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Adea, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Bashemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zipho, Gatam, and Kenaz. And Timnah was a concubine. You see, with all these different wives and concubines and everything else, you get quite a mixture. You just imagine all the ethnic groups. And you're looking at the both the Ishmaelites and the Edomites. They are mixtures. There seem to be all these factions. They're always fighting amongst each other. Well, it's no wonder, because they had all these different wives. They had all the different concubines, and they have different ethnic groupings within the same ethnic grouping. The grouping is actually loose. And Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare Eliphaz Amalek, who was the son of... these are the sons of Esau's wife. So Amalek is a son of Esau, or grandson of Esau, isn't it? But it's part of Turkey. Again, it's probably an area within Turkey or associated with Turkey in some way. But Amalek, in Jewish history, they put it down to Armenia. The Jews put it down to Armenia. In fact, it's not. Armenia is not likely to be the case at all. They are much more civilized, quite frankly. Dr. Hay certainly had certain things to say on that. But Amalek was a son of Esau. It's, as far as we know, it's Turkey today. Then it also, the Philistines, going back to Psalm 83 again, the Philistines. And as far as we can understand, they are still in the Gaza Strip and Palestine. They're still bred into, mixed in with the Arabs, but they're still part of that particular grouping that you find there. The inhabitants of Tyre. Now, obviously, Tyre, as a city, was destroyed. The isthmus was completely removed, and the entire city went underwater. But Tyre is a bit more than just the city. Tyre is the area as well. If you think of Israel, and you go up from Israel, going up towards Galilee, and you look across east, you look across the Golan Heights, which is Syria, you have Lebanon coming down the coast there into Israel. There's a projection that comes into Israel in that particular area, and they have all kinds of problems from that particular area, that area of Lebanon. That area of Lebanon is the area of Tyre. That is the area of Tyre. So when we look at that, and then in addition to that, Asser, or Assyria, is also joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. So there seems to be a grouping between Assyria and Moab and Ammon, or Jordan. They've helped the children of Lot. Now, when we look at, you start putting some flesh on the bones like that, and you start actually seeing the nations that we've got today, and how these nations fit together, you can see all of these nations, basically, with the exception of Germany, who are basically against Israel, the nation of Israel. Well, it's going to be, they're against more than just Israel. They're against the nation, the tribe of Israel, the one on which the name Israel actually rests, which is Ephraim and Manasseh, which is Britain and America. And certainly in reading this particular psalm, and we read, for they've consulted together with one consent, they're confederate against you, the tabernacle of Edom and the Ishmaelites, the Moab and the Hagarines, Gerbil, Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre, and Assyria also is joined with them, and they've helped the children of Lot. Selah. Think about that. Don't just sing over it, but just read over it. Because I say, these individuals are very likely to influence and have an impact on us. Because why? We're talking about the hidden ones. Who are the hidden ones? If it's not the church, who is it? Who is it? But then it goes on and says, Do unto to them as unto Midianites, and to Sisera as to Jabin in the book of Kisom, which perished at Endor, which became as dung on the earth. Now, these are referring back to things that happened in the time of the judges. And if we turn back to Judges chapter 4, now, time of the judges was not a particularly good time to be living in Israel. Everybody doing what seemed right in their own eyes. There was no king, there was no priest in that sense. But in Judges chapter 4, verse 15, and Deborah said to Barak, up, for this to the day in which the Eternal had delivered Sisera into your hand. Is not the Eternal gone before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. And the Eternal discomfited Sisera, and all his chariots and all his hosts with the edge of the sword before Barak. And so Sisera lighted down off his chariot and fled away on his feet. But Barak pursued after his chariots and after the host. And in fact, Barak didn't go ahead and get Sisera at all. Sisera went ahead and took sanctuary in somebody's tent. It says, howbeit Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael, the wife of Herba, the Kenite. There was peace between Jabin and the king of Hazor and the house of Herba the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn in, my lord, turn in to me, do not fear. And when he turned into her and to the tent, she covered him with a mantle and put a blanket over him and said to her, give me, I pray, a little water to drink, I'm thirsty. And he opened a bottle of milk and gave him to drink and covered him, and said to her, stand in the door of the tent. And basically what then happened is she killed him. And Sisera lay dead with a nail through his tent peg, put through his temples, and he was killed by this woman that he got sanctuary in. So God was the one that orchestrated it, allowed it. It wasn't a great battle victory to Deborah and to Barak. It was, in fact, a great battle victory. Sisera died at the hands of a woman who was totally nothing to do with the battle that was taking place at that time. And when we go to Psalm 83, Sisera is mentioned as you know, due to them as unto Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin, in the book of Kisom, which perished at Endor, that became as dung on the earth. Now, they're merging several instances into the same thing, but I read that one about Sisera, because that, if you like, stands alone, stands to one side. But if we don't go in Judges 6, verse 33, chapter 6, verse 33, then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. Now, the valley of Jezreel is north of Samaria, and it was a place where the kings tended to, the flat area, and it's the area of Armageddon, quite frankly. It's the area where the armies will gather for the final time and come down into that, the destruction at the hands of Jesus Christ. But here it says, but the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. And he sent messages throughout all of Manasseh, who also were gathered after him. And he sent messages to Asher and to Zebulun and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. And Gideon, remember, this is before David, you know, long before David. So there's no kingdom of Israel and kingdom of Judah. It was all one nation. And Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I'll put a fleece of wool by the floor. And if there is dew on the fleece only, and if it be dry on the earth besides, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so, for he rose up early in the morrow, and thrust the fleece together, and wrung the dew out of the fleece in a bowl full of water. And Gideon said to God, let not your anger be hot against me. You see, he didn't trust himself. He didn't have much hope in it, about this huge army that had gathered. And therefore, you wanted, you know, it's like, who was it that said, if you're not coming with me, I think it was Joshua, wasn't it? If you're not coming with me, I'm not going. And Gideon said to God, let none of your anger be hot against me. And I'll speak but this once. Let me prove, I pray you, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon the ground let there be dew. And so God did so that night. It was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew on the ground. Now, you try doing that sometime. You know, it just doesn't work that way. If the fleece is wet, the ground is wet. If the fleece is dry, the ground is dry. You don't get an opposite with one or the other. But here in chapter 7, in verse 9, and it came to pass the same night that the Eternal said to him, arise, get you down to the host, for I have delivered it to your hand. But if you fear to go down, you go with Phurah, your servant, down to the host, and you shall hear what they say, and afterwards shall your hand be strengthened to go down to the host. And they went down with Phurah. In other words, if you were fearful, then do this. And immediately the next thing it says, so he went and got his servant and went down to the host. And at the outside of the armed men that were at the host, and the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number, there's a sand of the seaside for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream to his fellow. And he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, the cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came into the tent and smote it, and it fell, and it overturned it, and the tent lay along. His fellow answered and said, this is nothing except the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel, for into his hand has God delivered Midian and all the host. It was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation, he worshipped, and returned to the host of Israel, said, arise, for your Eternal has delivered into your hand the host of Midian. So what is actually being said in Psalm 83 here is, sort these individuals out, sort this confederacy out, from Assyria all the way down to Gebel, or to the area of the inhabitants of Tyre in Lebanon. And the way to sort them out is so that God's name will be held in high regard and held in high esteem. Because what it not only was Deborah and Barak mentioned here, but this, all the other areas that you find here, you find to do with Gideon and this, let's go back into chapter 7, verse 1. And Gideon and all the people with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Harod. And the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moab, Morah in the valley. The Eternal said to Gideon, "The people that are with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" So God wasn't wanting that. This is the same Jesus Christ that will return, and the same Jesus Christ that's going to deliver Israel of old, of modern Israel. The same one that delivered Israel of old is the same one that will deliver Israel today. "Now therefore go and proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead.' And they returned to the people 22,000, and there remained 10,000. So that thinned them down a bit. So anybody afraid, and Gideon had to be encouraged with his fleece and hearing the dream of the barley bread. "And the Eternal said to Gideon, 'The people are yet too many. Bring them down to the water, and I'll test them for you there. And it shall be of whom I say to you, this shall go with you, that then the same shall go with you. And of whom I say to you, these shall not go with you, the same shall not go.' So he brought down the people to the water, and the Eternal said to Gideon, 'Everyone that laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps shall be set by himself. Likewise, everyone that bows down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that lap, putting their hand to the mouth, were 300 men. But the rest of the people bow down on their knees to drink water.'" And that separated out 300 individuals. They weren't chosen, they were chosen, but they weren't somebody special. They weren't particularly valiant or anything special about them. The only reason for doing that was to show God's power and God's strength. So when we read in Psalm 83, "Do unto them as unto the Midianites, which perished at Endor, became as dung of the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yes, their princes are Zeba and Zalmunna." Now these individuals, these were the kings of the Midianites in this particular instance. And so the people, and basically if you look in verse 19, "So Gideon and 300 men that were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. And they had but newly set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in the hand. And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers and held the lamps in the left hand and the trumpets in the right hand." You know, so the clay pots, a blazing torch, and a trumpet. The swords, if they had swords, they were still in the sheaths. And they blew the trumpets, they broke the clay pots, and waved the things around. And they stood every man in his place round about the camp, and all the host ran and cried and fled. "And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Eternal set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout the whole host. The host fled to Bethshitta and Zereth, and the border of Tabith, and the men of Israel gathered themselves together," and so on. But they fled in absolute panic. And again, God caused this panic to come upon them. And he says, "Who said, 'Let us take to ourselves the house of God in possession?'" This is Psalm 83 now. In verse 14, "Oh my God, make them like a wheel." And they use a wheel to winnow the grain. They used to have a wheel, you know, turn a wheel, a large wheel over the grain to take off the chaff. And as stubble before the wind, they used to throw the grain up, and the chaff would then blow away from the grain. "And as the fire burns a wood and the flame sets the mountains on fire," and what they do is they have the winnowing areas on hills all the way across the area. And as they threw the grain up and the winnow, all the chaff would blow away. They then set light to it, and you have these flames going on the hills all the way around the area of Israel in the harvest time. And therefore he's saying what is being said in this psalm is, you know, all the chaff, the bit that is not needed, the bit that is they've been confederate against Israel, been confederate against the hidden ones. You know, let's get rid of them and then, you know, be ready for the millennium, be ready for the millennial rule. And the fire burns the wood and the flame sets the mountains on fire, so persecute them with your tempest and make them afraid with your storm. Fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name. Notice, that they may seek your name, O Lord. Now, if we turn, I won't turn back there. Just put in your notes Exodus 6 verse 3. It talks about how by the name of Yahweh, which it goes on, it says, let them be confounded and troubled forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish, that they may know that you, whose name alone is Yahweh, Yahweh, Yah, I was, Yahweh, again, how it's pronounced, nobody knows how it's pronounced, but it's a three-syllabled pronunciation, presumably, was, am, and will be, on the verb to be. And it's by that name alone, you are the Most High over all the earth. And in Exodus 6, verse 3, he says that by El Shaddai, the great blesser, he was known, but not by this name Yahweh. Now, in Genesis 22:14, you'll find that he was known. Yahweh was one of his names, and it was known by Abraham. But in fact, it hadn't been seen, the power had not been seen. And it's the same as being mentioned here, that the men may know that you, and it's, men is in italics, so it's that these individuals may know, these individuals that are in confederacy against God, against the hidden ones, against Israel, because Israel is going to be the model nation in the future, that they may know that you, whose name alone is Yahweh, are the Most High over all the earth. If we turn over a final scripture, over in Isaiah chapter 63. Isaiah 63. Who is this that comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? Is it glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength? I speak in righteousness, mighty to save. I that speak in righteousness, the living word, in other words, the living word of God, the one that became Jesus Christ. And this particular individual, why are you red in your apparel and your garments like him that treads the wine fat? Again, it's going back to Gideon and how Gideon didn't save Israel. God saved Israel. In fact, Gideon was deliberately made to whittle down the number of people involved, so that God would have the credit. Why are you red in your apparel and your garments like him that treads the wine fat? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in my anger and trample them in my fury. And that's the confederacy that was one of the groups that would be confederate against God's people. And their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I'll stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore my own arm brought starvation to me, and my fury it upheld me. And I'll tread down the people in my anger, and I'll make them drunk in my fury, and I'll bring down their strength to the earth.